You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the meeting grounds for spirituality and society, religion and culture.
For 5,000 years or more than 15,000 generations, human beings have been invoking spiritual power. My predecessors and yours have gathered together to make sense of their lives and their place in the cosmos, and they have spoken aloud and invited what they conceived as sacred and powerful to be with them. They called upon the spirits of earth and air and earth, fire and water. They called the bear and the deer. They asked the raven to protect them. They pleaded for the heroes of old to slay the monsters of their fears. They sang songs they learned from their grandparents and moved to the appointed ways, or in ways that were new but felt like the right thing to do. And they imputed power to these spirits and to the memories of those heroes. They called them gods, and they were invoked. Vishnu and Kali, Elohim, Odin, and 100 million others. Every group of people everywhere. They gathered to make sense of their lives and to make sense of their place in the cosmos, and they called these spirits to be present to them. So do we. We gather this morning to make sense of ourselves and this universe in which we live, as best as we are able. And we call ourselves to worship together, and we invoke the power and wonder of life itself, that to which all the spirit, those spirits of animals and memories of heroes pointed the way. We invoke that power, which is, we know, always around, always with us, but which we sometimes forget about. We forget that we are part of the whole of creation. We forget that we are stardust. We forget that we are capable of miracles, first among them, that we can love. We forget these things, so we invoke the power of existence so that we can remember. So we can lift our eyes and open our ears to the true and beautiful. For 5,000 years or more, we have done this. In many tongues, in many ways, we have done this. And so we continue that ancient tradition in our way and in our time. And so let us now worship together.
Thank you, John. To worship means to raise something to worth. And so in welcoming you here today, we raise to worth the nameless urge that brought your free spirit here, or brings your free spirit back to us. Whether you're a refugee from righteous religion, a rambling rebel, or a rusted-on regular, what we do here today is meant for all of you. Ah, it's the coldest time of the year. It's winter, it's dark, it's cold. We're indoors a lot. So it really is as good a time as any to really bid the dark welcome. And by the dark, I mean the persistent mysteries of our human life, areas of our vast unknowing. This is a series of three themed services: our mysterious past, our unknowable future, and our built-in fallibility. Last week, we looked into the dark depths of our human origins as a response to the age-old question, where do we come from, and found the joy of our deep interconnectedness. This week, we explore the other end of uncertainty. Where are we going? Well, obviously, the destination we all have in common, the number one certainty of human existence, is that we're all going to die. Our unique and precious individual lives will come to an end, regardless of how we've spent our living. The richest person in the cemetery will be just as dead as the poorest. The nastiest will be just as dead as the nicest. The most accomplished just as dead as the one who never quite found themselves. Being spiritual or religious doesn't let anyone off the grave. Or not. Being stoically brave or serene or mortally terrified about it doesn't let you off. Death is the same whether whined at or withstood. It is the one and only certain future we all share, and I know you all know that on some level, but we live in a time in history and in a culture that is in real denial about it. Just ask yourself, has this little talk been comfortable even this far? We go to elaborate lengths to ignore it, to keep it at arm's length, out of sight and out of mind. And of course, that distance only feeds rather than relieves the deep anxiety that causes the denial. I want to emphasize that our current cultural taboos around death, though normal for us here and now, are not the general human norm, not the general human view of mortality. Only a few generations ago, the Victorians were positively, morbidly obsessed with mortality. Partly, I guess, because Queen Elizabeth spent her entire reign in mourning for her dead husband, Alfred. They had, you know, a new thing called photography, so they would actually dress the dead up like they were living with their eyes open and pose them in a chair as though they were still alive. Families got together and posed with the bodies of their deceased relatives. These are two twin brothers. One on the right is no longer with us, but is with us. The Victorians talked about it, highly ritualized it, and whole artistic movements came out of this fascination with death. We, on the other hand, our culture, we use euphemisms to talk about it, passing away, going on before. We hand death over to sanitized and sanitizing businesses run by smooth, discreet professionals to deal with all the nasty bits. We are kind of the anti-Victorians. Death is taboo for us, whereas sex is everywhere. Death was everywhere for them, but they never talked about sex. But there's more to it than just time. Other more traditional cultures treat death very differently and have throughout history. This is the Mexican Day of the Dead, which is positively celebrated. Skull motifs are everywhere. There are parades, pageants, feasts. They celebrate death, make art about it, even keep the remains of their ancestors close at hand and have no problem handling their remains, bathing and dressing them annually, as in the Manene festival in Sulawesi, literally dressing them up, washing them, and parading them around the town. Or, in other cultures, placing remains out in the open to be shared among carrion animals, as the so-called sky burials are about. I spared you a real photograph of that. That's art about it. Now, I'm aware of our delicate sensibilities around death. I'm not insensitive to it, so there's no need to dwell on such images. But regardless of history or culture, this one certainty is what has puzzled us and continues to puzzle us since we first became self-aware. How can a thing so quick and fizzing with life suddenly become just another kind of inert matter? What is it that's fled? Where does that go? What happens to us when we die? Now, I'm certain that you all come already preloaded with ideas about these questions, so it might be good to air them. Sitting around you are your neighbors who are every bit as mortal as you. Take a couple of moments and share your thoughts with them on that question. Make sure everybody gets a chance to have their say. Doesn't need to be an essay, just a few words. Get it off your chest. Yeah. I'll give it a couple of bars. All right, I want you now to stand as you're able and remind yourself that you still live and move and have being. Reach out and hold on to the person next to you. Touch them, sing, move. Up on your feet, please, if you can. We're going to sing Comfort Me. Comfort Me. What will become of us when we die? I'm sure you have your views. Though our beliefs may differ, there are some things we actually know will happen. And they are summed up in this elegant reading. Listen to it, and then I'll tell you who wrote it, and you probably won't believe who wrote it. We are a momentary arrangement of atoms and molecules. An arrangement that lives and moves, to be sure, but an arrangement. An arrangement that thinks, laughs, appreciates beauty, dreams, and loves, but a mere arrangement nonetheless, a transient state, an ephemeral gathering. Soon, the arrangement will dissolve. Molecular bonds released by entropy, but the molecules that once were you will still exist. The atoms that made up your body, iron, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all the heavy elements forged in the crucibles of dying stars, will remain. Liberated from their temporary home, they will rejoin the rest of the planet, taking new shapes, finding new arrangements, becoming part of other life. You will become merged with everything. You'll become part of the trees that grow wherever your ashes are scattered, joining the ecosystem of the forest. You'll be in the slow green heartwood of the trunks of trees as they patiently tick off the centuries, in the buds that burst forth in spring, and in the leaves that explode with color in autumn. You'll sink into the earth and mix with the groundwater, eventually flowing back and rejoining the ocean where all life on this planet ultimately began. You will be in the waves that crash on the shore, in the warm, sheltered tidal pools, in the coral reefs that bloom with life, and in the depths that echo with whale song. You will be subducted into the planet's core and join the 300 million year cycle of the continental plates. You will rise in the sky and in the fullness of time become dispersed throughout the atmosphere until every breath will contain part of you. And billions of years from now, when our sun swells and blasts the earth away, you will be there, streaming into space to rejoin the stars that gave your atoms birth. And perhaps someday, billions of years yet beyond that, on some distant planet beneath bright alien skies, an atom that once was part of you will take part in a series of chemical reactions that may ultimately lead to new life. Life that will in time leave the sea that gave it birth, crawl up onto the beach, look up into the cosmos, and wonder where it came from. And the cycle will begin again. Pretty good. And scientific. Do you know who wrote that? This guy. Catholic priest, Jesuit, Vatican astronomer, native of my hometown of Baltimore, and indeed a graduate of my very seminary. For those of you who think that we're the only smart church, or that any other mainstream believers are merely deluded, superstitious, myth-clutching sheep, his approach almost proves that old-timey hymn we never really believed, almost true, we will all meet again on a beautiful shore in the sweet by and by. Father Coyne puts much better than I ever could the case for our immortality by material entropy, but I'm not sure that you find that utterly consoling. To know that although you won't be aware of it, your bits will go on and on forever, changed, as Eckhart Tolle puts it, like this: you're the universe expressing itself as a human for a little while. Is that completely consoling? I didn't think so. There's for me, I took a long time furnishing this mind, our present awareness of our own being that will be gone. And so we'll have nothing to think with, nothing to feel with. It'll be the same state of being we had before we were born. There will be no I. Ah, ego. We're so attached to it. It's a good servant for earthly survival, but it's a bad master for our spiritual growth. The human ego, in the face of its own annihilation, has constructed through its powers of abstraction and imagination many non-material afterlives that preserve the ego, preserve the individual awareness. Maybe some faraway realm of box seats from which we'll still perhaps be watching this world the way humans watch a play, not part of it, but in a position to reflect and judge and be happy it's not us up there. Heaven, Valhalla, Paradise, the Elysian Fields, these sorts of places where you go and just watch things on earth pass like a play. Or some people think we keep coming back for repeat chances, like, you know, the death in a video game, to get this game of life right so we can be released from it, like it's a perpetual recycling, an upcycling of an I that keeps growing. Buddhism, being Buddhist, rather annoyingly deconstructs the question and comes closest to the entropy model of Father Coyne. There is no self to lose. Self keeps changing moment to moment. Ergo, the arrangement into me is a temporary state, and we're released upon death back into what we truly are, matter and energy. But there have been a couple of interesting developments lately on the question, what happens to our consciousness after clinical death? A team of researchers at Southampton University in the UK recently conducted one of the largest ever studies about what happens to consciousness after death. They spent 4 years examining 2,000 people who suffered cardiac arrest. 40% of these people who survived described some kind of conscious awareness which continued for up to 3 minutes into the period where their heart wasn't beating, even though the brain shuts down 20 to 30 seconds after the heart stops. These people gave detailed reflections of sensations, sights, and sounds that were consistent with and corresponded to real events going on around them in the room. They couldn't have sensed them. Now, how long this lasts, nobody knows yet. The study doesn't tell us. But it suggests that consciousness and the body might be entangled actors somehow, and that they unravel and follow separate paths after what we refer to as death. But by far, now that's interesting and all, but by far the most significant recent advance in considering what happens to us when we die has been the emerging field of biocentrism. Developed by biologist Robert Lanza and astronomer Bob Berman, biocentrism applies the principles of quantum physics to the problem of life and death. And of course, quantum physics show that both space and time are essentially illusions constructed by the particular structure of our mind. If what quantum physics tells us is so, death as we know it may not indeed mean oblivion. Few key points about biocentrism. You know the Schrodinger's cat experiment. I'm sure Neil does. The cat both is and isn't living, and you don't know until you lift the box. Quantum physics allows for multiverses which exist simultaneously laid over one another, and since energy never dies, it can move between these universes, and consciousness is the main game of life anyway. Now, this is heady stuff, and it is well beyond the scope of this little chat, but do yourself a favor and read the book, Biocentrism. You've got Robert Lanza on Time's top 100 most influential people of the last decade. Or at least Google the word if you're not going to read the book. It's the most exciting and compelling approach to the question of what happens to us when we die, which has perplexed us since we came out of the trees. Our culture is unique in its inability to face death. However, all philosophy since Socrates has been driven by how to die, the good death. Socrates said that philosophy was learning how to die, which is about gaining the wisdom to live a really good life so that when death comes, we can approach it with dignity and equanimity.
Is there life after death?
I don't know.
Is there life before death?
Absolutely.
We don't all need to be philosophers to create a life well lived, and so
prepare to die with dignity and equanimity. You might be familiar with the concept of bucket lists. Experiences or achievements folks want to tick off before they kick the bucket.
Hence the name bucket list. And bucket lists are cool and you should probably do one, but there's a tremendous class privilege inherent in bucket lists. It can be more about consumerism than love of wisdom, which is what philosophy is. So we can do better than that. And bucket lists can look like the Christmas wish list of a very indulged child. Instead, I want to challenge you today to come up with a be-it list, which is very different. A be-it list, not a bucket list. Take a moment or two to think about this. What would you like to be remembered for or are most passionate about? Who is the authentic you? Who are you deep down? And name, this is the important list part, name the qualities you still want to grow in. And during coffee or next week, come and write it up on the scroll by the pulpit. Now, there's no need to sign them, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. Write it big. This is important, and it's going to be ongoing and up here for a couple of weeks, because this list is going to help me frame services and pastoral work over the coming years. If I know what qualities you still want to grow in before your inevitable end, then I'll have some better idea of how to serve your needs. We have so little power over what will become of us and what the world will become after us. We do have to live, however, in some kind of hope. And we can have hope in what we do have power over. And what do we have power over? We have power over ourselves. With that in mind, I want to leave you with the words of the poet Mary Oliver, who said, "I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention. Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Amen. I leave you with words today from an Inuit song. "I think over again my small adventures, my fears, those small ones that seemed so big, all those vital things I had to get and to reach, and yet there is only one great thing, to live and see the great day that dawns and the light that fills the world." So may we all. Amen.
Rob McPherson's addresses are his intellectual property. They may only be used by other preachers if his permission is sought and expressed, acknowledgement is given that they are his work, and the addresses are used in their entirety. To seek his permission, email Rob at unitarianessay@bigpond.com.
That's our episode of Expanding Horizons for the week. The introduction is a piece named Elements by the artist CDK. The piece is licensed under Creative Commons. This is White Rabbit, out.